the problems around teenage sleep difficulty. Teenagers claiming they can't sleep, difficulties with social media, computer use, iPads, also more pressures around school, interactions with their peers, increases in mental health, problems with sleep hygiene, and falling asleep. Teenagers are undergoing a time of significant change in terms of hormone production, brain development, social and emotional development. A combination of biological changes, increasing drives for independence, increasing school and social pressures can come together to impact negatively on sleep. Today, I'm meeting Dr. Paul Jeffrey. He's a clinical psychologist who has worked and trained at the University of Western Australia with experience of over 20 years. He has a special interest in sleep psychology. He also works quite closely in the pediatric and adolescent setting. His clinical practice puts emphasis on the formation of safe, ethical, therapeutic relationships to facilitate collaborative and goal-directed therapy. I'm really interested to look at how he manages sleep problems in the teenage years. Now, this is the end of Series 2, and I wanted to say a quick thanks, no matter where you are in your walk of life, for tuning in and supporting the Kids Health Network. I also owe a huge thanks to all the experts, allied health professionals, pediatricians, and any pediatric specialist who has joined me on this program over the last 20 episodes. I have been inundated with support, and it's been really fantastic to hear from everyone who has become involved in this program. I look forward to the next series with what I hope to be more really interesting topics. And if you do have anything you'd like to hear about, please email me at kidshealthnetwork@outlook.com. In the meantime, I'll be back shortly with more episodes.
Raising children can be one of the most challenging life journeys you will ever take. This is the Kids Health Network podcast, supporting happy, healthy children and demystifying common medical and psychological problems with experienced health professionals. Hosted by father of two and general practitioner, Dr. Andrew Leach.
Get in touch with us with ideas. Email kidshealthnetwork@outlook.com. The Kids Health Network is a support service for kids and their families. Please rate us on iTunes. Thanks for tuning in.
Teenagers require more sleep than most other age groups. This is important for healthy brain development and learning. The problem we are now seeing is teens are losing sleep as they prioritize other activities, including social interactions and screen time. Their sleep times are getting later and later and shorter. They have to get up at the same time each morning, though, for school, for example. I'm with Dr. Paul Jeffrey today, and he's a clinical psychologist, and he has been working for the last 20 years in this field and specializing in sleep disorders. I'm joined by him today in his clinic in Subiaco. Thanks for joining me, Paul.
Hi, Andrew. Nice to be here.
So today we're here to talk about this very challenging area of sleep problems in teenagers. Why are some teenagers so bad at sleeping, Paul?
Oh, that's a big question. Look, with teenagers, we probably see the same individual differences in terms of what their sleep needs are like. So whether we're seeing kids, teenagers, or adults, we do have quite a bit of variation. But for the teenagers that are pushing the envelope with their sleep and probably not valuing their sleep, or where a range of different things are coming up that are potentially interfering in their sleep, then the effects for their well-being, their mental health, their ability to concentrate, learn, etc., can be quite pronounced.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I guess maybe going back to what is sleep, and that might be an area that you're particularly interested in. What is actually important about sleep, and what are some of the aspects of sleep that help a teenage brain in particular, restore memory and function?
Yeah, so sleep's, we're still probably trying to really get a good understanding of what sleep actually is. You know, in a lot of animal species, organisms literally will die if they don't sleep. if they're deprived of sleep or unable to attain sleep. So it's literally a matter of survival. When it comes to the things that help us with sleep, broadly speaking, it's about physical restoration and mental restoration. So when it comes to physical restoration, kids and teenagers need sleep to help them with their growth, with their tissue repair, healing. In terms of mental restoration, we know our dream sleep is incredibly important for helping with things like consolidation of memory, consolidation of learning. We know in sleep there's also a bit of a cleaning up process that happens where the brain sort of build up of plaques that can develop over the day are literally sort of cleaned out by the process of sleep. We're deprived of sleep, that build up over time can be counterproductive for brain functioning. So yeah, really crucial on both the physical and mental side of things.
Mm. So we talk about REM and non-REM sleep.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means? And does it change between age groups, the duration of those different periods and what happens in those different
sure,
periods?
Sure. Yeah, so people can sometimes have the perception that we essentially just fall asleep and stay asleep and we dream a little bit somewhere in there and then we wake up. But what we know is that sleep, from sort of early to mid-childhood onwards, sleep essentially takes on a pretty characteristic pattern. So we'll have lighter stages of sleep, stage one and two sleep, where the brain is just moving from a state of wakefulness into the brain activity more characteristic of sleep. And then we'll have a deeper or stage three of sleep, which is probably the stage of sleep where we're pretty much impossible to wake us up from. We're in a very deep stage there. And then after that comes REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep. And that's where we know most of our dreaming, nightmares, things like that take place in this REM stage of sleep. So we typically will go through about a 90-minute cycle at a time. So from lighter sleep to deeper sleep and then back up into a brief period of REM sleep. We might have a very brief period of awakening and then we'll essentially go back through another 90-minute cycle. So we'll go through a series of 90-minute cycles across the night. Teenagers will have a pretty similar pattern to adults. When children are younger, their stages of deep sleep and REM sleep can be a little bit longer, but by the sort of late adolescence, we're looking at a fairly sort of typical sort of adult pattern.
Mm-hmm. So they don't need more of them or they don't need a longer sleep?
Well, so in terms of the total sleep time that we need, one of the really interesting things that teenagers will convince themselves and try and convince everybody else that they just don't need as much sleep as they used to. Mm. But in fact, we know most of the recommendations for sleep duration for teenagers still looking at about sort of 9+ hours that we need, again, with individual differences. Mm. But compared to a primary school child, we might be looking there at sort of 10 or more hours, but the difference in sleep need between, say, a 16-year-old versus a 10-year-old is really not that great. Mm. But the differences in what they'll actually get can be substantial, again, because of, you know, lifestyle choices and different pressures and demands and things like that. So,
and we're going to get onto that.
We will. Yep.
I'm also interested in body clock. Like, is there any rule about when a teenager should get to bed or when they should get up, or that doesn't really matter? That's just a personal choice. And same, I mean, might as well talk about, you know, some of those school age kids as well. It doesn't really matter as long as they get that number of hours sleep. Does that impact on the quality of their sleep and how refreshed they'll feel? Should they be setting alarms and getting up at a good time? I'm just curious as to how you see that. Yeah.
Well, what I might even do is take a couple of steps back before that, Andrew. You mentioned body clock, but probably to have a good discussion with your teenager about sleep, it's good to sort of understand some of the other mechanisms around sleep and kind of what governs it. So a body clock is one of the mechanisms that governs our need for sleep, otherwise known as the circadian rhythm. That's essentially influenced by our exposure to light and dark. So there's a part of the brain called the pineal gland which is susceptible to light exposure. When we're exposed to light, the secretion of something called melatonin in the brain gets switched off, and that essentially creates the conditions for wakefulness in the brain. When we're exposed to dark, the pineal gland detects this and melatonin secretion commences. So that's typically in the evening, of course. So the circadian rhythm is one of the big influences on our sleep. It essentially runs on a 24-hour cycle, but it has what we call sort of a biphasic cycle. So we often feel a little bit sleepy or tired after lunch, and in some nations they'll have a siesta. Then we'll feel a little bit more alert in the early evening, and then we'll kind of head more towards our kind of more profound need for sleep in the later in the night. So along with the circadian rhythm, there's also something called the homeostatic sleep drive. And that's essentially the longer we've been awake and the more energy we've expended, then the greater our need for sleep becomes. And that operates a little bit like hunger. You know, when we're feeling hungry, we'll eat something and that feeling of hunger will disappear. We'll feel satiated. And then the longer we go without food, the more hungry we'll become.
Okay.
So the homeostatic sleep drive operates on a similar homeostatic sort of mechanism.
Okay.
Yeah. The reason that's important, we'll talk about a little bit later, but the homeostatic sleep drive and the circadian rhythms can sort of go hand in hand. But when our habits are sort of messing with that, it can get a little bit out of whack. The third mechanism that we like to sort of understand what's going on for people is that of arousal. So we know that in terms of things that can interfere with sleep, when we've got a lot on our plate, when we're worrying, when we've got stresses and pressures from the day, or indeed if we're worrying about the fact that we're not sleeping well, then high arousal can also interfere with sleep. So they're probably the three areas that we're kind of most interested in. Of course, you get other health conditions that can sometimes contribute to poor sleep with kids and teenagers. Airway restriction. And some kids just naturally have narrow airways, or they might have adenoids and things like that growing that need a little bit of a look at. Other health complications, chronic pain conditions for some young people, even though they're perhaps a little bit more rare than with adults. So there are some other things that can interfere, but generally those three areas, the one I mentioned, are the ones we tend to look at.
I guess going by symptoms first, what might be some of the signs or symptoms? A teenager is not getting enough sleep. Can a parent tell, talking or looking at a teenager, that there are concerns about sleep? And then maybe we can go into each of those categories that you've just mentioned.
Look, unfortunately, some of those signs and symptoms can just be like signs of being a teenager too.
Exactly.
But probably as a parent, you know your teenager, and you get to sort of see some of the subtle shifts in ups and downs. So in the literature, I guess there's a concept around excessive daytime tiredness. What does that actually mean? Well, I suppose it's having difficulties shaking off that initial feeling of sort of sleepiness and tiredness at the beginning of the day. We all feel something called sleep inertia, which is probably the first 20 or 30 minutes of the day. Unless we're a real morning person, we can just feel a bit sluggish, but that's normal. Mm. It's if teenagers are spending the first 2 to 3 hours of the day and they're still feeling like they're semi-dozing their way through their first period at school, that you could probably be thinking that there's something, they're getting shortchanged with their sleep. So it's that real sluggishness and tiredness lingering in that first 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
You're probably also looking at things like difficulties concentrating, feeling irritable, moody, running out of energy sort of, you know, during the middle of the school day, starting to feel sleepy towards the later periods.
Yawning.
But yeah, it's probably the kind of the mood and irritability, concentration issues, not taking things in, not being able to retain information as easily. And then that real sluggishness at the beginning of the day.
And it's important that we recognise sleep as a problem here, because they can often be mislabeled as a distracted child, as a misbehaving child in school, as ADHD, as something else, an anxious child, when really there's a problem in the sleep department. So that's why I was just looking back at, you know, what other symptoms we could be looking at in terms of what's going on with sleep.
Yeah, with children, you're very likely to see behavioural issues and kids who are struggling to regulate their feelings very successfully. So they'll you know, get upset at the drop of a hat or find it hard to bring themselves down. Perhaps as we're getting into the teenage years, a bit less likely to see those behavioural disturbances. But the longer I've worked in this field, the more I've learned the value of just screening around those basic daily routines. You know, are we getting enough sleep? Are we getting decent nutrition? What are our basic routines and habits like? And sometimes something that can look like a behavioural disorder, an anxiety disorder, a mood disorder can sometimes be better explained from poor sleep.
So we know that there are a lot of modern day things going on with teenagers that can really interfere with their sleep, and things are changing. Technology's getting into the bedroom now, and schools putting pressure on kids to study on their iPads, and you know, they're up late doing that. So what other things are you seeing in practice that might be contributing to teenagers and poor sleep hygiene and therefore sleep going off as a result?
I'd say that this sort of battle and the tyranny of screens is the number one concern for parents across a whole range of different things, but certainly as it relates to sleep. It's interesting, the research is kind of still evolving in this area. So again, when it comes to the potential impact of screen time, and we use that term at its most broad, so that could refer to social media, it could refer to gaming, it could be browsing on YouTube, could be getting homework done. We think there's probably three ways in which screen time can potentially interfere with sleep for teenagers. So one of the ways is just purely through the erosion of time. It's just a bit addictive, you know. It's just that I'm one click away from the next interesting video or the next interesting story. I might be hanging out waiting for my friend to message me who's having a hard time with their girlfriend or boyfriend, and I'm trying to be a bit supportive. And so there's this literally just the slipping away of time, and there's strong, quite robust evidence now that it's that simple erosion of time that's one of the biggest sort of culprits. Possibly a slightly different set of challenges for young women compared to young blokes, although I don't want to sort of overly generalise, but it may be that, for example, young women are a bit more likely to get hooked into social media stuff. And where that kind of social acceptance and but also sort of social reciprocity comes in, that might be a little bit more of a draw for them. For the young blokes who might be, you know, gaming, going on their next mission with their friends or those, you know, people overseas or whatever it might be, that can be a big draw for
different
them
challenges for both.
Yeah, that's right. And of course they can overlap too.
Time quickly escapes too.
It does. And adults are susceptible to this as well.
Correct.
I do it myself. My wife, if she was here, she would tell us all about the ridiculous stories I could be following up.
Well, that we set the example. We are as vulnerable to this as the children and
absolutely
as the teenagers.
So there's that erosion of time. The second factor seems to just be one of physiological and psychological arousal. So again, when the content of what we're watching or looking at is engaging, it could be work, it could still be legitimate schoolwork. We know that obviously the more aroused we are prior to bedtime, the harder it is to get to sleep. So that's going to be an issue.
So what is it about that makes it hard to sleep? Why?
You probably need a neuroscientist or neuropsychologist to give you a really good answer here, but whether it's activating things at that sort of hormonal level, if we're getting like a little bit of an adrenaline surge going on from whatever it is that we're engaging in, then of course that's going to you know, we're activating something called the sympathetic nervous system, which is responsible for having us ready for action and on guard. Whereas sleep is supposed to be a time of reducing arousal, of actually literally letting go of being on guard. And so you've just got two systems that are working in opposition to one another.
Okay.
You know, we're thinking, we're analysing. It's interesting, even though, for example, TV watching in bed has long been regarded as a bit of a no-no, it seems like the correlational studies are suggesting that the impact of TV watching is less than the impact of interactive social media and other media types.
Okay.
We're just engaged differently.
Okay.
With that medium. So the effect is still there, but maybe not quite as pronounced.
Are we still worried about the idea of the screen itself affecting receptors in the skin and waking up the body? I've forgotten exactly how we're taught it at medical school, but it wakes up the... turns off the melatonin somehow.
Yes. Yeah. So, again, really interesting question, and that probably brings us to the third culprit. Remembering that daylight helps to switch melatonin off. The concern is that the blue light and the blue and green light frequencies in screen light might, in a sense, be tricking the brain into thinking it's daytime rather than nighttime. When you look into that a little bit more, there's a question over whether the intensity of light that a screen emits is really sufficient to trick the brain in that way. I've seen a rule of thumb published that suggests that it probably needs to be about 2 hours of close-in work with something the size of an iPad that would really need to be enough to suppress the melatonin system. The jury's still out on all of this. Devices have got their kind of nighttime modes, which is probably better than nothing. they sort of strip out the blue and green light frequencies from the display. But probably most of what you'll see in terms of published recommendations would suggest about a half an hour buffer, if not more, between when you're last looking at a screen and when you're trying to get to sleep.
Yeah, I guess that's where I was heading. Is what's the latest research saying about time between screens off and bed? And it's really hard for teenagers, adults, kids to not have screens before bed. Yeah. There's just so much on there that they could be doing before bed that keeps them entertained, to help them switch off, to help them relax. And I get that. Mm-hmm. It's a good wind down tool, I guess. And so, you know, I'm realistic about that when I'm talking to them. But is there any research now that says, look, 30 minutes before, like you've just mentioned, or 1 hour before, or are we still at a loss as to exactly how long before you should be, you know, using it? Yeah.
Look, at this stage, it's probably still rules of thumb. It's as I understand it, I'm not a researcher myself, but I understand it's sort of difficult to do experimental research in this field where you're looking at sort of cause and effect. And there's an interesting sort of train of inquiry that's sort of saying, look, maybe the kids who are staying up late are getting hooked into this stuff are doing that because they're poor sleepers and they're drifting onto screens and devices and things because they can't sleep. I think there's no doubt that it's not a helpful it's not a helpful thing. What we've probably found through our own experience in working with families, and also stuff that you probably see from other people working in this space, is that probably prevention is better than cure.
Yeah.
And I think if you can create that sort of family ethos right from the word go, that we have a switch off and that we're valuing our sleep, that the world doesn't come to a grinding halt if we're away from our home. Much easier done from the word go. But if you're there, for those parents listening who've already in the midst of it all, then the other thing that we found is really important is education. I haven't met too many teenagers who are really hell-bent on self-destruction. You know, there's a function to their behaviour, and whether they're labouring on a misapprehension about whether something is okay or not, we find that if we help teenagers understand what goes on with sleep and some of those different mechanisms that we've talked about already today, then you can make the pitch for why changing this habit or adjusting this habit might be important. And if they can understand the basis for it themselves, then I think sometimes you're more likely to get a bit of buy-in from your teenager.
Yeah, a little bit of education can go a long way.
Yep.
And I guess that's where a psychologist could be useful. And it might be something they didn't realise that they were doing, that, as you say, they just haven't got that level of cortex to help understand what they're doing that might be affecting their sleep.
It's always that tension between immediate gratification
yes.
and the longer term.
Yes,
longer term good.
That's right. And we touched a little bit as well, just moving away from screens, we touched about other areas of sleep disorder in teenagers. So medically, there are problems that need to be considered. So there are looking out for sleep disorders such as restless legs. Mm-hmm. Sleep apnea is a problem that I often screen for with parents, looking out for snoring.
Yeah.
It can be missed throughout the younger years, the large tonsils and adenoids problem, and be picked up much later. And really important that area does get looked at. So I don't know if you notice that in your work as well, or it gets sort of moved towards the GP end. But that's a really important thing. You know, that the child who has that sort of obstructive sleep disorder can have lots of problems through their learning and development at school.
Absolutely.
And their concentration and their ability to function. And sleep disorder, I feel, flies under the radar. I don't know what you see, but that's what I find.
Yeah look, probably by the time families make it to our front door, then they've often been through a reasonably thorough sort of workup. Generally speaking, I think for the teenagers, where we were going with the screen stuff is around something we call a delayed sleep phase.
Okay,
so teenagers can be susceptible to a shift in their body clock where they just naturally don't need to go to sleep as early as they used to, but there's a propensity to want to sleep in. So that delay, we call it a delayed sleep phase, can sometimes look a little bit like insomnia. Insomnia, on the other hand, is where the individual's body clock is still sort of normally timed, but they are struggling with, again, things like arousal, worry, a lot of mental activity that interferes, and they're trying to get to sleep, they're wanting to sleep, but the individual is struggling to fall asleep, and the frustration and anxiety sort of builds from there. The sleep apnea, the sort of breathing obstruction, you probably know better than I, but yes, it's often things like, you know, a little bit of snoring or kind of events where they're struggling to breathe properly can be a bit of a giveaway there, and especially the excessive tiredness during the day. You know, things like restless leg syndrome or sleepwalking, things like that are a little bit less common, but can sometimes interfere as well.
That delayed sleep phase, has got the ability to permanently change the body clock of a teenager? And if it does, how do you bring it forward? You know, I've often seen teenagers say, I just can't fall asleep when I go to bed.
Yep.
So how do you fix that?
And they're not just being naughty.
No.
So it's interesting. I was looking into this a little bit more before our conversation. Apparently it happens across a lot of mammal species, not just humans. And the shift seems to coincide with the finalization of puberty. And you can see a shift of anywhere from sort of 1 to 3 hours in when the person's body clock is telling them that they're ready for sleep. It tends to peak around the late teens, early 20s. And then through the course of adult life, it starts to retreat back to a more kind of civilized time. And as you and I know, whence kids come along, that can force the issue a little bit for younger parents. There is a rhythm to it over the course of a lifetime. So you're not stuck forever, but you can certainly... And the difficult things for teenagers is that they're still trying to operate according to a schedule that says, you've got to be up and ready for school, you've got to be up for training, whatever it is that they're trying to get ready for. And again, depending on the teenager in question, if they value their education and they're trying to do a really good job, they can feel... you know, highly pressured to be burning the candle at both ends. One of the real pitfalls, unfortunately, for teenagers is that they'll try and have a big catch-up sleep on the weekend. So we might be going through the week only getting 7-8 hours sleep, being short-changed, get to the weekend and have a sleep until 11 or 12 o'clock in the morning. But all that does is just set you up for another bad week. So you can imagine, remembering we talked about something called the homeostatic sleep drive. Mm. If I've slept until midday on Sunday, I am not going to be ready for sleep by 10 o'clock on Sunday night.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're just perpetuating a vicious cycle.
Starts again.
Yep. And so that's where you see the body clock and the sleep drive kind of coalescing to be a real vicious cycle.
They think it's a solution, but it's actually...
It's not a solution, no. So when we're trying to help kids to reset their body clock or work better with their body clock, it's the regularity of the wake-up time that perversely is probably the most important thing.
Okay.
Even though the nighttime routine is crucial, we need to have a really clear pathway that says, hey, it's time for me to go to sleep. Mm-hmm. So down tools, do something quiet, read a book, listen to some music, have a nice shower, something that just gives us the brain a signal that it's time to start winding down for bed. But it's the regularity of the wake-up time and exposure to sunlight that can really help to kind of reset that body clock. So I'm sorry, teenagers, but yes, what that means is the end of the weekend sleeping. We're better off trying to get up about an hour to an hour and a half. So let's say if we normally get up at 7 or 6.30 during the week, ideally we're still looking at sort of an 8 o'clock or an 8.30 get up on the weekend. And then, you know, if we're needing to catch up a little bit, we'd rather see just a brief nap during the day as a way just to get a little bit of restoration. Now, before I hear all the parents switching off going, that's just never going to work, we need to remember as well that there are big individual differences here. Okay, so there are, of course, plenty of teenagers that get away with a weekend sleep in and it doesn't seem to do too much for them in terms of a poor knock-on, and that's fine. Okay, but for your teenager who is really struggling and you're looking for a way to resolve the issue, this can be one way that you can start to make some inroads.
Yeah, there's so many uniquenesses between each child that you know, you have to apply it to your own situation. But I guess to sum up nicely, that waking with the light, using the light, but also having a really nice wind down routine, a nice comforting environment, a nice shower, music, using something, you know, calming. I often tell parents about different podcasts or Smiling Minds or a mindfulness app. There's lots of different things out there. Do you have any other tips just to help with parents guiding their teens towards a better routine to finishing the end of the day with their teen?
I think it's an elusive combination of treating them as a capable, mindful young adult.
Mm.
You know, they're
independent.
They're independent. Mm. They yeah. I think when we give teenagers credit for actually understanding things and being able to make sensible decisions, I think if we're seen to
empower them,
that's right. Mm. Then I think they respond well to that. Having said that, I think you also need to be prepared to set limits. You know, I've had plenty of parents who have felt absolute hostage to their kids, you know, needs and their kind of demands for you know, limitless screen time, and my friends all do this. And but I think the way through that again is probably just through conversation. You know, if there are issues with being able to stay on top of schoolwork, if we're overloaded, if we're feeling pressured around what we're trying to do, then how can we have a problem solving conversation to sort of say, hey, what are some other ways we can help you to manage your workload here? Or, you know, if teenagers have got friends who are in a bit of crisis and they're feeling the need to be up and about, you know, on standby, on guard, it really scares me to think of the number of teenagers out there who are supporting one another through even sort of suicidal crises and things like that, that we just never get to see.
Mm.
They're often handling a lot more than we realise, and they're probably not going to tell us the real nuts and bolts of it, but they'll often have a misguided sense of responsibility. I'm the only one that can help my friend here, or if I switch off, you know, they're going to be doomed. And so, it's just trying to find that sensible middle ground. You know, what are some different ways you can be a support for your friend? Let's see what happens if you just say to your friend, look, I'm here for you up until this point, but then after that I need to get some sleep, you know. And and often teenagers are more forgiving of one another. It's the pressure they put on themselves that kind of leads them into some risky decision making. So I think trying to just have those problem solving conversations with them to say, look, these seem to be the things that are getting in the way. I wonder if there's any other way we could work around this so that you can still kind of achieve some of the things that are important to you and also value your sleep at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, it's really good advice. You know, what's holding you back from good quality sleep? What's playing on your mind? And what interactions are affecting you? Any good resources that you give to parents or that you know about that might be useful for them to look at? Any websites or resources that you know of?
There's an online program called Sleep Shack, which comes out of an evidence-based approach to helping teenagers, particularly with that delayed sleep phase phenomenon. I think it costs a bit for people to register and use it, but that's, if you wanted to go as far as that. In terms of information, Sleep Health Foundation, which is an Australian body, they put out tip sheets and resources for people to look at, and there's definitely material on there around things like, the teenage sleep and some of the issues we've covered today. And in terms of the whole screen time and so on and so forth, there's been some podcasts that have come up recently, I think, on Maggie Dent's Parental as Anything podcast, and also conversations with Richard Feidler. You know, just looking at sort of that interaction between teenagers and screens in general, and kids and screens, and there might be some interesting stuff there for people to listen to.
I'll put all the links to those up at the bottom of this podcast. There was just one other area we probably didn't explore or do justice, and that was mental health and teenagers and the effect that can have on poor sleep. And it's probably a whole nother podcast. It's a symptom in its own right. Poor sleep as a result of poor mental health. I don't know if you wanted to comment on it, but I see it a lot, and teenagers are vulnerable to depression. What do you feel, how do you think this can be approached in practice?
So as you say, it's probably a whole topic for another conversation. Certainly with things like anxiety, you're going to often see, especially difficulties getting off to sleep. That's a time where parents will, I'm sure those will be familiar with, your child pulling you aside and trying to open up that big conversation about something that they're worrying about, it, you know, as their head hits the pillow. So anxiety and insomnia go hand in hand. Depression can sometimes either rob our sleep or it lead to something called hypersomnolence, which is excessive sleepiness. So there's absolutely links between mental health and poor sleep, and they go both ways. We know that poor sleep contributes to mental health problems. Mental health problems contribute to poor sleep. The interesting thing is helping consolidate sleep can actually then help with our general adjustment and mental well-being. It's not necessarily the case that you've got to treat the mental health problem in order to improve the sleep.
So it's such a good point. I often get asked whether medication would be useful, and in certain situations it is useful. It's worth having that chat with your GP. I mean, there are various medications out there now. It certainly has to be dealt with case by case. And if there is enough severity of the sleep disorder that there is, you know, depression occurring or there is anxiety occurring, it may well be that medication helps to lift those symptoms. But, you know, I would be encouraging you to see a GP to discuss that. And so, yeah, that's a really great point, that, you know, helping sleep can help mood, and helping the mood can help the sleep. They work hand in hand. Look, that's a good way to finish, but Is there any other closing points? I think you've been fantastic to talk to. We could talk another hour. It's been really, really interesting. I'm sure we'll catch up again sometime. Thank you, Paul, for your time.
Pleasure. Yeah. Thanks, Andrew.
This has been another Kids Health Network podcast. The information and advice provided here is for general purposes only. It is not an alternative to the medical advice offered in person by your GP, paediatrician, or other health professional relating to you or your child's specific condition. If you have concerns that you or your child is acutely unwell, please seek immediate medical attention. For more, find us on Facebook or Instagram at Kids Health Network.